The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is Suzanne Spaulding, the Senior Advisor for Homeland Security, as well as the Director of the Defending Democratic Institutions Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She was the former director of what is now the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at the Department of Homeland Security, and she was also a commissioner on the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. Suzanne, thanks so very much for joining us.
Margo, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's always an honor and a pleasure. And before we get started, our daily podcast is sponsored by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Suzanne, new administration is in office and obviously has a major cyber crisis on its hands, Russia's SolarWinds attack, crisis that was identified, by the way, by a commercial firm. And I want to get to that in a minute. The administration has yet to name a national cyber director, but Ann Neuberger has transferred from the National Security Agency to the White House to serve as the cyber director on the National Security Council. What is the new administration's approach towards cyber has to be, especially in the wake of the SolarWinds attack?
First of all, the good news is that it's clear this administration, from the very most senior levels, from President Biden himself, understands and takes very seriously the imperative for improving cybersecurity. And has a number of folks in senior positions across the administration who have worked on cybersecurity issues in the past and really have bring a strong understanding to that. SolarWinds responding to the massive attack that started perhaps with SolarWinds, although we're learning more and more all the time about the scale and scope of this attack and may have involved a number of vectors beyond just SolarWind. But that has to be a top priority, obviously, for the folks coming in. And I think within that crisis, one of the first things that has to be focused on is stopping the bleeding. It is understanding the scale and scope of the damage. And I don't just mean damage to computers and networks. I mean, understanding what is the possible consequence of Russia, to whom this attack has largely been attributed, having access to those networks and systems. What could Russia do having had that access? Whether it is access to data, the confidentiality of that data, the fact that Russia now knows whatever that data is, to their ability potentially to corrupt the integrity of that data or access to that data, to understand what harm could come. And then importantly, how do we mitigate those damages? How do we reduce those risks? So that is an important analysis. It's the kind of a work that you do after you catch a human spy. What did they know? And so what do we need to do? Do we need to extricate our assets overseas? Do we need to do operational activity differently? That's the first thing I think that needs to be happening. Even as we look at how we defend against future attacks of a similar nature, building resilience, in making a bigger push for basic cyber hygiene that could have prevented some of this, to things like that the commission has recommended certification and labeling, what some folks have recommended, an NTSB type function, lots of activity to look at, and then securing our supply chain. So that all needs to be a priority. I think at the same time, another priority for our cybersecurity folks has to be looking at the potential impact on our effort to deal with COVID. I think COVID is a number one priority, if not the number one priority for the administration coming in. And there is an important cyber component to that as well.
It certainly helps to have a president who's engaged and says that this is a priority and assemble a very talented team. And we will see who other members are, but everybody who's mentioned are folks who do have good cyber chops to them. But ultimately, we're in this position in part because there isn't that urgency that this is really important, that everybody is on the front lines. As you mentioned, right, I mean, very early in the pandemic, there was concerns about how Russia and China might be trying to benefit from all of the vaccine research, for example, in the United States, or take advantage of the distraction that was happening. How do we get that sense of urgency, Suzanne, to sort of power us over the finish line? Because this SolarWinds attack is not the biggest, but it certainly is the latest one. And this sort of stuff keeps happening. I mean, that was one of the intentions of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission that you serve on was, hey, let's do a 9/11, you know, a 9/12 assessment to help prevent 9/11. What's it going to take to become urgent enough to drive all of these changes that are necessary, but somehow don't quite get over the finish line?
Well, again, I'll start with the good news, which is that we did get a number of things over the finish line in the Defense Authorization Act. So a surprisingly large number of recommendations from the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, on which I serve, were included. I think around 25 different recommendations that were included in one way or another in the Defense Authorization Act. And I say surprising because I've been involved with a number of commissions over the years on a variety of subjects and never seen that kind of uptake on recommendations. So I do think that, you know, Congress takes this issue seriously. You know, another piece of good news is that Congress has generally approached cybersecurity as a bipartisan or nonpartisan issue. And there's certainly more to be done there, but I'm relatively optimistic that we can continue to get support from Congress for the things that they can do. But there's a limit to what Congress can do. We've got an executive branch that is seized with this issue. There's a limit to what they can do. Where we are really struggling is getting the private sector on board to prioritize cybersecurity. And there, I think, too, we're making progress, but there's still a lot of work to do. I think some of it, and we talk about this in our commission report, will come from all of the things that we recommend that will help folks calculate the return on their security investment. I think when CISOs in the private sector go to their CEO, who goes to the board, to budget a significant resources to improve their cyber resilience. And that's not just technology on cyber, but resilience against successful attacks as well. That it's very difficult to lay out for them in a concrete way the return on investment. And that's really a data collection effort that for which there are a number of approaches.
We should point out that the co-chairs of the Solarium Commission, Angus King and Mike Gallagher, joined us last week to talk a little bit about what they have accomplished and what more they want to accomplish over the next 2 years. Everybody talks about, Suzanne, the public-private partnerships that are going to be necessary on this. What are the kind of partnerships that are necessary, right? I mean, FireEye is the company that discovered the SolarWinds attack. It wasn't CISA, and I'm not trying to be critical of anybody in government, nor was it an intelligence agency. At the end of the day, what is the kind of cooperation that is going to be necessary between private industry and the government to make sure that we're as successful as we can be, including supply chain security, right? I mean, this was a software update that was compromised that then allowed the Russians to get into networks all around the world.
Yep. So, you know, as you know, Vago, we've been talking public-private partnership for so long that the words have lost their meaning and most folks just roll their eyes. But in our Solarium report, we talk about operationalizing that relationship. And that's really where we need to move to. It's not just about pushing information back and forth at each other. It's about coming together to increase our understanding of what that information tells us, and to be able to bring to the table the resources and the authorities and the capabilities that each of us has to address the threat, whether it's in the context of planning, operational planning, where the private sector needs to be at the table, to responding, detecting and responding to attacks. So we need a much more collaborative working relationship and not just an information sharing relationship. And again, we've got a number of recommendations along those lines, but I think we need to start with the most significant players. And so we've recommended identifying systemically important critical infrastructure, those pieces of our critical infrastructure that have systemic importance across a national critical function. And that's why the work that CISA at DHS, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is the organization that I used to lead at DHS under a different name, the work they're doing on identifying what are those critical functions that Americans depend upon, that are essential for our government to function in the most important ways, for business to function, for individuals to be able to be safe and secure. What are those key functions? And then we need to look at all of the ways in which we can come together collectively around those critical functions. And that will help us identify parts of the private sector that may warrant extra assistance from the government and perhaps extra obligations as well, because they are so systemically important. And so those are some of the things I think Congress will begin to look at.
What are the elements, you know, Chris Krebs, your successor in that job, who served with some distinction, right? I mean, every administration builds on the preceding administration. What are some of the elements of the Trump cyber agenda that you think were valuable and worthy of building on to try to get to this better cyber security that we want to do, right? I mean, there was CMMC at the Pentagon, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification. What were some of the things from the last administration that this administration has got to build on?
Yeah, CMMC is certainly one of those. It's still a lot of work to be done there, but the concept is a good one. And again, I think continuing to resource and really push hard on identifying those national critical functions. And part of the, you know, Chris was wonderful coming in and kind of, as I've said, picking up the baton and running with it. And I'm optimistic that his successor will do the same in understanding that the ways in which physical and cybersecurity are inextricably linked, and that they have to be looked at in a holistic way. And that includes, again, thinking about the ways in which we understand the consequences in the real world of a successful cyber attack and how we minimize those consequences. And so think, for example, paper ballots. Paper ballots were a way of addressing the consequence of the insecurity within our election, whether from information operations or potential cyber activity, because we looked at the consequence. What is the consequence of that insecurity? It is a loss of public confidence in the legitimacy of the election. What are all the ways we can restore or sustain or reduce the risk of that loss of confidence? And paper ballots is one of the ways, an analog solution to a cyber-enabled threat. So that work, which you know really took off over the last 4 years, is an example of the kind of thing that needs to continue. I also think we continue to mature on our ability to attribute malicious cyber activity and to go public with that. And the American public was, you know, with an increasing number of those announcements and attributions, is able to put it in better context. So all of that is a you know, hoped for maturation that I think will continue.
And I should note, as a program note, former Deputy National Security Agency Director Chris Inglis and Josh O'Sullivan of Artilist are going to join us next week to discuss CMMC and how the new administration should be building on that. How does the United States need to respond, right, both inside and outside, to solar winds? What's the response to the Russians? And what are some of the things that we need to be doing immediately at home, right, that goes beyond merely assessing the problem, but some of the direct actions that will be necessary as a consequence?
Yeah. So in terms of consequence, you know, I have to say I've been a little frustrated with folks who say, this is just, you know, traditional espionage, spy versus spy, you know, good on you. You know, we do the same thing. And therefore, we can't, you know, complain about it. First of all, I don't think it's accurate that with respect to traditional spy versus spy, that we do nothing about it. In the, again, going back to the physical world, when we caught a spy in this country, there were consequences. And you may not get up on your moral high horse, but it doesn't mean that you just shrug your shoulders, right? We would kick people out of the country. We would close down diplomatic facilities, all kinds of things. So there's that. And I also think this is not just traditional espionage, because so many of the victims are in the private sector. I think this goes beyond traditional espionage, and the scale and the scope of this is significant and is very serious. And I think we need to convey very clearly to Russia that we take this very seriously. And I know that this administration is looking at potential ways in which they can send that signal, some of which will be public and some of which won't be. In terms of, you know, again, what we need to be doing beyond what I've already discussed, which is to understand the harm that could come to us from this and all the ways in which we can take steps now to reduce that harm. We do need to be thinking about how we then build resilience going forward, right? I think people need to be really taking to heart what some folks call a zero trust kind of model for operating. You do everything that you can within reason to prevent a successful cyber intrusion, to limit the damage they can do to your network and system once they're in the system. But then again, you need to think about if they are successful in getting in and moving through your system, what harm can they do? What are the things you would worry about most? And then how do you build resilience? How do you mitigate their ability, even once they get in, to do harm? Because that's an important part of the deterrent strategy. Right? Deterrence is about altering your adversary's cost-benefit analysis. And we focus a lot on how we increase cost to the adversary, but we also need to think about how do we reduce their bang for their buck? How do we reduce the benefits that they can get from their successful malicious activity in cyberspace? So that's an important part. I do think that we need to get to that place that automated information sharing at DHS was designed to move us toward, which is where we are all sharing threat indicators and threat information and malicious cyber activity that we see and detect immediately with each other. So that, again, an adversary can't use the same tactic over and over again with multiple victims, but that the first entity that detects it is able to get that information out in an automated way immediately, so that it doesn't have the same level of success with subsequent victims.
Let me ask you. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, thank goodness FireEye, came forward with that information. But we have to look at how do we make that a regular, more regular occurrence.
And certainly, right, I mean, getting to the point where everybody takes it seriously and is open about it, right? I mean, Tom Fanning of Southern Company, who is one of the cyber commissioners, I think had it right, that there has to be, that companies should be open and honest about this at the end of the day, just like they have to be about their financials, which will become a financial driver for companies to take this seriously and make that kind of investment, which unfortunately sometimes doesn't get as much, you know, and companies kind of have a tendency, even major financial ones, to sweep it under the rug, unfortunately. Let me take you to the issue of disinformation and domestic extremism. One of the things Chris Krebs was passionate about was to try to fight disinformation as much as possible. But at the end of the day, he worked for a president, and I don't mean this in a partisan fashion, who did engage very successfully in both disinformation and misinformation. And that misinformation and disinformation over prolonged periods of time is what is feeding domestic extremism, which we saw erupt on January the 6th. As somebody who studies this, including at CSIS, Suzanne, I mean, you know, I know that you're passionate about civic education as being kind of a key in this, but how do we fix this ecosystem now? There are people who are in their information silos. They believe what they believe over a course of long periods of time, but some in short periods of time because they are hearing it from their political leaders or political leaders that they affiliate with. I mean, at the end of the day, how do we do this? Because it's a very, I mean, you have to convince people what they believe is false, right? How do we do this? Because people are acting obviously on this faulty information.
Yeah, well, it's a complex challenge, but I think we have to break it into its component parts. It's not all one thing. So just as when we looked at countering, violent extremists from foreign terrorists, we distinguish between those who are committed to conducting acts of violence, the terrorist leaders, members of terrorist groups, and the broader population in which they are able to recruit, for example. And then even beyond that, the sort of loved ones of those who may be being targeted for recruitment. And I think we need to take a similar approach here. So the aggressive activity around arrests and prosecution, identifying, arresting, prosecuting those who engage in the attempted insurrection on January 6th is really important. I think we do need to have a concerted effort to make clear that that spreading lies by our political leaders is not acceptable. And I think, frankly, the action that the House is looking at with respect to a member of their body who's been spreading disinformation and lies is one of those steps. But I think we also need to reach out to that broader community. And one of the things I think we need to think about is, and I've been trying to sort of think about is a year of civic renewal. You know, as we come out of the isolation of COVID, hopefully over the coming year, where people are not interacting personally, physically, but are being drawn into this disinformation vortex online, for example, as we, emerge from this incredibly divisive election and the attempted insurrection, how do we rediscover a sense of civic identity, a sense of community, and come together in ways that that help us to rediscover our shared values? And that's where I think civics education is so important. I think civics education is a national security imperative to remind all of us of the values that serve as the foundation of our democracy and the role that each of us play in that. And the ways in which we can bring about change, not through violence, but through constitutional means. We need to be empowered. We need to be educated and empowered to be effective agents of change. But we also need to work together side by side in activities in our communities all across the country. And I look to our communities to come up with innovative ways in which you get people out. I think if you spend a day, for example, picking up trash or painting a school next to somebody and then find out that they have dramatically different political views from yours, it's a little harder to demonize them than if you're just engaging online. So I do think there's everything from that very specific and concrete to this longer term effort to build resilience against pernicious disinformation that would seek to divide us and to get us to despair and turn to violence.
I understand the importance of building community, Suzanne, but are there, how do we fight, are there technical means? Are there, obviously there's turning off of accounts, which is what social media companies are doing. There's Section 230 and how we change that. On the technical side, I mean, when lies are coming at a volume, I mean, how do you counter something that is this vast in terms of the challenge, right? I mean, the personal piece and the education piece is important, but there are people who live in this ecosystem now and maybe acting on them, right? I understand putting behind bars those who, transgress, but how do you sort of move that needle in terms of the missing, is there, in a country that believes in the freedom of the press and the First Amendment, how do you get that line right to identify to people, hey, what you're hearing now is false?
So I think this is where the social media platforms really have to step up. They started to do that in the context of the election. They've done a bit of that in the context of COVID. So in those areas where they have recognized a public imperative, because the potential harm to the nation and to individuals is so great, they have stepped up and they need to continue to do that. They need to adjust their algorithms and the way in which they treat online content so that they are promoting more authoritative sources, so that they are removing and labeling, removing as appropriate under their terms of service and labeling false information, misleading information. I think these are certainly removing inauthentic accounts and inauthentic activity online. I think they've taken steps in the right direction, but they need to be much more aggressive, I think, in helping us to reduce the pull of that, what I call that disinformation vortex, that their current algorithms perpetuate.
And then, of course, right, is the good old-fashioned calling them out as you see them, right? Call out a lie. If you see something, say something and do something, as opposed to just merely repeating it, would also seem to make a little bit of sense. Suzanne, thanks so very much. It's always an honor and pleasure talking to you. Always enjoyed and would love to have you back on for a deeper conversation. Thanks so much again.
Thank you.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.